All right, we're going to go back to the seventh commandment and say a little bit more. Not only are these sins forbidden, adultery, fornication, homosexuality, pornography, but also lust. That is, thoughts about these things, the entertaining of the thoughts about these things, the passion that accompanies the thoughts about these things to imagine and to entertain the thought of committing adultery or fornication to stir up the desire for that by viewing pornography. Here's what Jesus says. He says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery,' but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And how seriously does Jesus take that? He says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away, for it is better that you lose one of your members, the members of your body, parts of your body, than that your whole body should be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away, for it is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell." That's how seriously Jesus takes this command. But that's the very thoughts about these things that violate the commandment. You've committed it already in your heart. So how far should you stay away from these sins? You should flee from them. That's the admonitions of the apostles. You don't flirt with sin. You flee from it. Flee youthful lusts, the apostle Paul says. Flee immorality, the apostles say. Flee every form of evil. You don't see how close you can get to it without crossing over the line. You stay as far away from that line as you can. And then we also want to add to this list divorce. Divorce violates this command because it violates this commitment, this verbal, physical commitment. And Jesus says that when you violate that verbal, physical union, that you are violating this seventh commandment. So Jesus says, whoever divorces his wife, it is also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So that if a man were to, or a woman were to divorce his or her spouse and sever this, the verbal bond, and then marry another person, that new marriage and the physical union that takes place in that new marriage violates this physical bond that's still intact. And so every divorce, according to the teaching of Jesus, involves adultery. It is either the context within which the divorce is permitted, or adultery is committed as a result of a divorce that is not authorized. So if you think about marriage as having these two bonds, the verbal and the physical, and a man divorces his wife, he divorces her, there's still this physical bond that's intact. He marries another person, he then violates the physical bond, and that's an adulterous act. On the other hand, what Jesus is saying about permitted divorces, if you have a verbal bond and a physical bond, and one of the marriage partners violates the physical bond, Jesus is saying that the innocent party can then break the verbal bond, and that's permitted. That it's only when it's only when the verbal bond is broken, and then another marriage takes place, that the physical is violated and adultery takes place. But so you can see that every time there is a divorce, there's adultery involved. Either initiating the divorce because there was adultery committed, and then the severing of the verbal bond and the ending of the marriage is permitted, or there was adultery or there is no adultery and the verbal bond was ended through a divorce, but through the courts. But because the physical bond was still intact, then if there's a subsequent marriage, that marriage is adulterous at its inauguration. And that's why Jesus says everyone who divorces his wife, except for the ground of sexual immorality, where it would be permitted, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman who is divorced under these circumstances commits adultery with her as well. All right, let's move on to the eighth commandment. The eighth commandment is, thou shalt not steal. So if the seventh commandment was about the sanctity of marriage, the eighth commandment is about the sanctity of property. And the sixth commandment was about the of life. So you see that the negative prohibitions, the thou shalt nots, have behind them a positive principle. Sanctity of life with the sixth, sanctity of marriage with the seventh, sanctity of private property when it comes to the eighth. And so the commandment is thou shalt not steal. Why not? Why can I not steal what belongs to another person? The answer is because it's not yours. While we are all stewards of what we have, because everything that we have is given to us by God, He did not give everything to everybody. Stewardship is personal and private. And so private property is authorized by God. That which I make, that which I own, belongs to me, and it doesn't belong to somebody else. And they don't have a right to it. And if they take what is mine, that I have either acquired or inherited, but is rightfully mine, and they deprive me of it by stealing it or damaging it or harming it, then they are depriving me of its value, and they are stealing, in actuality or in effect, they are stealing from me. So the eighth commandment is, thou shalt not steal. That's question number 73. What is required in the eighth commandment? The eighth commandment requires the lawful procuring and furthering of wealth and outward estate of ourselves and others. What is forbidden in the eighth commandment? The eighth commandment forbids whatsoever does or may unjustly hinder our own or our neighbor's wealth or outward estate. So the lawful procuring and furthering of wealth. So what I may not do is I may not acquire wealth through stealing. I may not acquire wealth by bribery, by bribing another person. I may not acquire wealth by deception. So I am to acquire wealth only by lawful, that is, as approved by the law of God, only by lawful means. What would be some examples of lawful means? By hard work, by legal transaction. So I go to someone and I buy some item from them. I buy a cow. I buy a little lamb. I buy their car. I buy their lawnmower. Legal transaction agreed upon by the two parties that are involved in the transaction together. Unlawful. Gambling. All of our theological ancestors, all of our ecclesiastical, churchly ancestors would agree, gambling is not a legitimate means by which to acquire wealth. You're toying with the providence of God. You're rolling dice in order to acquire wealth. How are we to acquire wealth? Through hard work. That's our wealth is to be the fruit of our labor. Another lawful would be inheritance. It is lawful to inherit property from another person. Parents can pass on their wealth to their children, or pass it on to their nieces and nephews, or pass it on to anyone that they please to pass it along to, so that I can receive wealth as a gift. And that is permitted. There can be occasions when excessive taxation can be a kind of theft, taking what belongs to others. I would say even, not exactly property, except it's intellectual property, I would say cheating. Cheating on tests, cheating in the writing of papers. You're stealing the answers of another person. That is a form of theft. When you're looking on another person's person, looking over their shoulder during an examination, that's a kind of theft. That's an intellectual theft. You're stealing the knowledge that belongs to another person. You don't have a right to that. So for you to take it is a form of violating what belongs to another. So it's not just material property. It would have to do with intellectual and mental property as well. Another thing to take into consideration would be if I damage somebody's property and thereby deprive it of its value. So, for example, if I run a stop sign and crash into another car and damage that car so that the car then loses $2,000 of value, I'm required to compensate them for that. I need to hand over $2,000, or my insurance company needs to. I have robbed them of the value of their automobile. You know, if I were to plant a bomb in my neighbor's house and blow up their house, that would be, again, robbing them of the value of their property, and I should be required, God would require it of me, that I would restore fully what I have damaged, restore that value, because through my negligence, or my evil intention, I have deprived them of the value of their property. I've stolen that value from them by my carelessness or by my cruelty. I have taken what belongs to another. So you see, these are fundamental, foundational principles of human freedoms, human rights. That which is to be sacred in human life, and with that which is the foundation of our laws. So that life is sacred, marriage is sacred, property is sacred. And our laws, both divinely given and those that our civil authorities create, need to recognize these sanctities, and the laws need to be structured to protect these sanctities. So we sometimes complain about how many lawyers we have in this country. But one reason why we have those lawyers, and why it is in many ways a good thing, is that it's common in many parts of the world that if you hire somebody, or you get hired by somebody to go work in his field, and you spend all day working in the field, at the end of the day, he'll say, come back tomorrow for your pay. You work another day, he says, come back tomorrow for your pay. You work day after day. You may work for a month. You may work for 2 months and not get paid. And then at the end of it all, he just says, well, I don't have the money to pay you. And that's the end of it. In this country, you get hauled into court. And you are forced to, you are obligated, required to pay, to fulfill your obligation to your workers. And the reason is you have robbed them of the value of their labor. So that would be another thing that would be unlawful, would be the, you know, failure to pay, to not pay somebody for the value of their work. We positively, we are obligated to pay people for their work, for the value of their work, and to fulfill the contracts that we write. And that really is the foundation for our entire economy in this country, is the enforcement of contracts, which we'll see more about with the next, when we look at the ninth commandment.